Florida Business Minds, presented by the Florida Business Journals, and brought to you by Tico Peoples Gas, at the heart of Florida's energy. In this episode, South Florida Business Journal Editor-in-Chief Mel Melendez invites Apollo Bank founder, chairman, and CEO Eddie Areola to share the impact of community banking on Florida's growth.
All right, well, welcome, Eddie. Thanks for joining us. So, Eddie, you established Apollo Bank in 2010 and grew it into one of the largest community banks in South Florida. So much so that Seacoast Banking Corp is poised to acquire Apollo by the end of the year. So congratulations, that's a definite success story for you and the bank. And this is just the latest in a long line of mergers and acquisitions of banks across the state. And some people wonder how this consolidation trend will impact small business owners who rely on their relationships with community banks. Do you think that's a valid concern? And how can banks address those concerns?
First of all, thank you very much. It's always great to see you, and I'm a big fan of the business journals. So regarding the question, yeah, it is a valid concern, a sort of a broad sort of general statement. But when we talk about small business, things have changed, and there used to be small businesses, sort of the, how we pictured small business, a retailer on Main Street, a bakery, local print shop, whatever. But there's a lot of small businesses that are out of condos and houses or little warehouses that aren't even really local. You know, they're servicing clients across the globe and shipping across the country. And so they're even sometimes even their banking relationships are, you know, elsewhere. So I kind of like to think about local business and small businesses, and sometimes they're the same and sometimes they're not. And, you know, one of the issues is a lot of those small and local businesses never even relied on community banks and local banks. So yes, it's been disrupted. Yes, there is a concern, but it's kind of been, you know, I guess a disappointment or an opportunity lost by a lot of small and local businesses in the past that never really took advantage of a community bank. So, but overall, I think it's really good. Forget about it if it's even good. It's here. Like, consolidation is happening and will continue to happen in all sorts of industries because of regulatory issues and technology requirements, and it's hard to get people. So the local business and then the small business, which again, which are sometimes the same, they have to really figure out what are my technology needs? And a lot of times those businesses require more specific technology needs from their banks. And that may mean a much bigger bank. But there are banks, as an example. So Apollo Bank has always been a community-focused bank. And we sold our business to Seacoast. And they're very much a community-based bank. So they're keeping 100% of our employees because we're rooted in the community and only building out. So I think it goes back to know your banker and have a relationship with your banker, and you know, not just the bank and what the billboard is on the side of the building.
Okay. Now, as you know, banks became a lifeline of sorts for many business owners during the COVID-19 pandemic. And Florida's business journals documented how many community banks, including Apollo, were very successful at helping business owners secure their stimulus money quickly. So how have community banks benefited and built on the goodwill that stems from that?
With COVID, although it was terrible, community banks really sort of rose to the occasion. And sort of what we've always offered was this know your bank, know your customer, and build that relationship. That story really resonated for the first time in a long time. And community banks, as a general statement, were behind the curve on technology. And it required us to get techie really, really fast and deliver a banking solution without being face-to-face. And so we invested more, got quicker, figured out how do we work remotely. And that was the case for us, but it was the case for a vast majority of community banks. We really rose to the occasion. So that story now resonates with clients where they say, I should have a relationship in case things do go bad. There's always, you know, some sort of downturn, or I need to have someone really pick up my phone call. And for community banks, it really became, now we can send and receive information quicker. And, you know, overall competition is good, right? So bigger banks realized that they were, you know, behind the curve in certain situations, and smaller banks got better. And that competition is only good for end customers.
Now, you touched on how banks have been basically transformed over the past decade or so. And much of that was fueled by technology. But technology advances quickly. So what do you see as the biggest challenges that come with adopting technology?
The biggest challenges comes in what makes sense for you and for you being the bank and for the end customer. And so much of it is, you know, what's the sizzle and what's the substance? You know, like a big technology that people talk about is Zelle. Zelle became like a, especially during COVID, something that small and local businesses really started to use because it was a way to receive, you know, quick payments and electronic payments. And it was, you know, built into their banking accounts. And it was really pushed by Chase. And Chase did an amazing job. But then it pushed on all the other banks, like, oh, I better have Zelle. And Zelle's one, like one of my bank CEO friends calls Zelle like the mullet of technology, or it's, it looks good in the front, but it's a mess in the back. And so there's fraud issues on the back and there's operational issues in the back. So it makes sense for Chase because they own Zelle and they're pushing it and they get more small to mid-sized business accounts. But for other people, it's kind of messy. And I think clients are starting to realize that there is some fraud and it isn't perfect. So you have to realize, you know, again, what makes sense for you and what is real. And there's a lot of these, you know, quote unquote, you know, cool technologies that one of these days we're going to realize are a mess. So I think, again, you know, small local businesses have been able to access credit easier and quicker because of technology. So there's online lenders that have just been a godsend for so many businesses. And some of these online lenders have said, because of our technology and our AI, our algorithms, we're making better credit decisions quicker. In a lot of cases, it's BS. They're just assuming more risk and they don't want to admit it. And we're starting to see some of the, you know, as we start to work through this credit cycle, I think you're going to see that. And maybe that's okay, because if you want to assume more risk, God bless you. But I don't think it's really a technology solution in terms of how they're assessing credit. I think it's this technology solution on how you process information quicker and easier and create a greater customer experience. And I think that's okay.
Now, speaking of technology, Miami Mayor Francis Suarez aims to turn the city into a major international cryptocurrency hub. Some say banks can play a significant role in bolstering the crypto sector by adding more security to a largely unregulated market. But as you know, many of those that invest in crypto are drawn to it because it's unregulated. So where does that leave banks at a time when crypto and blockchain technology are just exploding? Do banks have a role to play in crypto?
So you hit the nail right on the head, which is people are attracted to crypto. Many people are attracted to crypto because it's not part of the banking system and because of the secrecy. And that's what, and banks do not like secrecy, and we are not allowed to operate in a world of secrecy. And I think one of the things that makes banks important and special is transparency. So at the end of the day, banks need to really realize that the most valuable thing about us and why we're important to a functioning economy and to a functioning financial system and why we're important to customers is the word trust. That you put your money in a bank and you know that it's going to be there when you wake up in the morning, which is not the case in every other country, why crypto is so important. But in the US, trust is the most important thing. So that means we know how to deal with regulatory issues, security issues, both cyber and physical security, that your money is stable. So again, crypto, it doesn't serve the purpose at this point of it being a stabilized currency. And people talk about using it as payments, but no one's using it for payments. People aren't, there's crypto millionaires out there that can't buy a house. And so they're having to find, you know, different ways. And they don't want to use the crypto for that way. So I think we need to view it differently than we've always viewed the dollar. And banks need to figure out, perhaps we don't play, or we provide the level that we always have to provide the level of trust. That if someone wants to keep their crypto in a bank or have some level of payments where there is transparency and it's not a secret form of information, or that they're willing to pay taxes and able to pay taxes, or they want to use it to buy a house or leverage. And banks need to build the infrastructure around trust and security to complement crypto. You know, we're kind of still operating in different spaces, and I think that's okay.
Now, South Florida is a very unique business market due to its diversity, its international transplants, and foreign investors. Can you chat a little bit about how that benefits our local and state economies?
So Miami's always been, you know, quote unquote, and South Florida's always been, but especially Miami, you know, quote unquote, you know, diverse city. And I think what, you know, generally people talk about diversity, in terms of race and color and country of origin and languages. And so that's always been sort of the story. I shouldn't say always. It's been the story for the last, call it, you know, 50 years in South Florida, because there was a time where it was small and Southern and white and that sort of thing. And that's changed. But now I think the big difference, the diversity, and I'm just talking about sort of from a financial standpoint, we get different types of money and people coming here. And so for the first time, at least in my lifetime, and I'm born and raised in Miami, is we're seeing folks come from, you know, Chicago. So it used to be people coming from Latin America, people sort of just getting away, saying, I'm tired, you know, I want the fun and the sun, I'm coming to retire. They're coming from Latin America, they're coming from Europe, they're coming from New York City to retire or just to get away. This is the first time I've seen where, you know, a couple different things. You know, folks coming from Chicago and LA, where there's so much job opportunity and great schools and those sorts of things. And they're moving away. And the thing I hear over and over is like, I'm just tired of the crime in those areas. Like growing up in Miami, like no one came here because they were trying to get away from crime. And so that's, I love that. Although, you know, we have our own issues to deal with. And then the other sort of, you know, from a financial standpoint, the first time in my lifetime is that we're seeing long-term money come in. Again, South Florida in general and Miami specifically has always been sort of a speculative market since Henry Flagler came down and started selling, you know, built his railroad and started selling land. It was always a speculative play. And then we saw that during, you know, leading up to the Great Recession, as you buy a condo and you flip it or whatever, I'm going to make a quick buck. You know, post-recession, what really shocked me, which I didn't have an appreciation for, where it was funds from New York, you know, sovereign wealth funds from Hong Kong or Europe or big family offices, where it was like multi-generational wealth coming and investing and paying, you know, what seemed like top dollar. And I mean, not understanding it. And because of the nature of what I do and talking to some of these people, and they're like, oh, maybe I'm paying like more now than the other guy down the street. But like, this is a 50-year investment. This is a long-term investment. And this is the first time where we have the diversity of funding and of investments that has driven up a lot of the prices in terms of, especially on the real estate side. But people are saying, I'm really going to build a business here for 20, 30, 40 years. People are moving from Chicago and LA not to retire or to have a good time. They're coming because they want to raise their kids here. They want to, you know, build out a business. And that's really exciting. So I think that level of diversity, you have a more educated professional workforce. You have folks coming from different parts of the country that come from areas that are sort of have a stronger, richer cultural history. The long-term thought process of investing in a community, in the city, and building it out for multi-generations.
All right. Now, by all accounts, South Florida weathered the challenges of the pandemic better than many other metro areas. In fact, COVID accelerated the trend of executives and companies relocating here. And you just touched on that. Can you share some insights on what you see as the pros and maybe the cons of this heightened migration?
The cons are kind of obvious, right? So it's like, oh, rising values of property and more jobs and, you know, cooler restaurants and maybe, you know, better concerts and all that sort of stuff. So, you know, I think that kind of, that story is well told. Being born and raised in Miami and where my kids are, and I hope that they come back and live here and raise families and, you know, building businesses and thinking about the people that work with me and for me, I spent a lot of time thinking about how it impacts us and potentially in a negative way. The big issues are still the big issues and only getting worse. So we still have, especially in Miami, and so this is where, you know, I highlight a lot of the good about Miami, we have terrible city and county government. We have, it's awful and only getting worse. And with the, one of the reasons I'm such a supporter of the South Florida Business Journal and media organizations like you guys is because media matters and you have to get out there and tell your story and have informed citizens. And, you know, with the demise of the paper in the Tampa area and the Miami Herald just getting smaller and less people reading it every day is very concerning. And you're, that's among the reasons why, you know, city and county government are, you know, you're attracting less qualified candidates. There's corruption and dysfunction and that's really bad and tragic. And when you have newcomers coming to the market, do they even care? Do they know the names? Are they getting involved? So that's a big, big issue. Traffic is still, you know, it's only getting worse. And there are more people maybe working at home or telecommuting or going to the office less. So maybe that helps out. But, you know, traffic's still going to be an issue. The public school system, you know, with more people coming, public schools and education is still a concern. So one of the big booms in South Florida has been private schools. So, you know, more private schools. The ones that are here have more resources, better campuses, more opportunities. But that doesn't solve the problem for everybody. That solves the problem for the professional and class and for the higher wage earners. And then, of course, the obvious one is housing costs. I mean, it's really, really bad. And, you know, people are fighting over rentals. And there's bidding wars to rent an apartment, and that's not good. And so we're, you know, we're definitely becoming a super city, and these are issues that probably, especially South Florida, needs to compare themselves to a New York, an LA, a London, and how they address them. But they don't have the best track record either. But so we definitely have our challenges to address, and all is not perfect and rosy in beautiful South Florida.
Apollo Bank's Eddie Areola joining us. In our next segment, he offers the common thread that runs through all Florida banking markets as Florida Business Minds continues. Through its innovation and infrastructure investment, Peoples Gas has maintained safe and reliable delivery of natural gas to homes and businesses since 1895. More about Peoples Gas at the heart of Florida's energy at floridasenergy.com.
What are some of the traits of South Florida's banking industry shared by other markets such as Tampa, Orlando, and Jacksonville, where we have sister papers? And what would you say make South Florida's banking sector different or unique?
Yeah, so, you know, South Florida is a lot more like New York City or LA than Tampa, Orlando, and Jacksonville. And I think that's okay. And I think that, you know, Tampa and Orlando and Jacksonville, there's stuff that we can do together. And there are certain businesses that want to be throughout the state of Florida. So as an example, Seacoast is a Florida bank and wants to be the biggest and best bank in all of Florida. But Miami is very different, which is why they acquired us. And they're keeping, you know, our team, and we have a different strategy than maybe the rest of the state. So, you know, again, we look towards, again, cities like New York City and LA because of the complexity of some of the businesses, the issues around housing, traffic, you know, schools and that sort of thing, and big, you know, city and county government that maybe aren't seeing such issues in some of the other markets. And then, of course, you know, the global influence. So we have, you know, a lot of international visitors and international clients, and how you handle that risk and how you service them. It is different. You know, cities specifically like Tampa, I think there are some similarities, and there's things that banks in Tampa can learn from banks in Miami. And we're doing that now with Seacoast. They see what a good job we do on what we call the global banking client, clients that have one foot in Miami and one foot, you know, somewhere else. That's a lot more what Tampa's becoming like. And so they're benefiting from, you know, how we service those clients. And you know, again, like a bank like Seacoast is going to really differentiate themselves and be a leader in Tampa for those types of clients. You know, Jacksonville is an incredible market. We just happen to be in the same state. But Miami and South Florida and Jacksonville are very different. And that's okay. So Jacksonville probably has a lot more in common with Savannah and Atlanta and Charlotte. And that's, again, I think okay. And if you're running a business in Jacksonville and you can differentiate yourself by having strong relationships with some of these Southern or sort of Atlantic Coast cities while also doing business in Miami, I think that's a really cool thing. But I don't think you look to Miami as your only gateway and opportunity to learn from and grow in.
Okay, now you touched on global banking, and because of your experience dealing with international clients, can you speak a little bit about the differences in working with international companies versus domestic ones? Because I can only imagine the factors like culture and regulatory issues and maybe even language. I mean, it's going to make for very challenging business dealings or more complicated business dealings.
So you're right. So you hit on some of the key ones. And so from my experience, the cool thing is that the international client is far more invested in the relationship with their bank. They're willing to give more time, more information, because they just can't walk down the street and walk into any bank and say, let's open an account, let me handle my payments or get a loan. They need to realize that that whatever bank they're working with is committed to that market and that client, and has a strong, you know your customer and understands the risk and is committed to servicing that types of client. So there aren't that many banks that are doing that. And, you know, especially the ones in South Florida getting really good. And I think, you know, Apollo Bank now is going to be part of Seacoast. City National, which is a big bank throughout the state of Florida and especially in South Florida and expanding, they have that level of expertise. And I think that'll be a very attractive to international clients. But, you know, like you said, you know, language, culture, and then, but overall, like a commitment to that market that you're just not going to, you know, close the door and walk away because something's going on in a certain country or because of the language or, you know, some sort of regulatory memo that comes out that you're just not going to shut the door on and some very special clients.
And because we're making such good time, I have a bonus question for you. A lot continues to be written about the Great Resignation and how challenging it's become to retain and hire top talent. How has the banking industry been impacted, and what can banks do to kind of address this?
So banks have definitely been affected like everyone. And what I always pull it back to, and as I've thought about this a great deal, and people talk about, well, do you have, you know, work from home, not work from home? We've been at the office every single day since this started because of PPP, and I've been in the office almost every single day. And so I don't think, you know, the key driver for most people is, am I in the office or am I not? And sorry, every situation is different. The most important thing that all businesses need to address is, what's your sense of mission? And your really good employees, I believe, still care about, if you have a sense of mission, this is what we are about, this is who we are for, this is why you should wake up every morning and compete with us or carry out our work. It's because it's important, because you like the people you work for, because you have certain key values. So sense of mission is, I think, one of the best ways to address sort of the Great Resignation type issue. Of course, culture is really important, and culture, one of the components is having fun birthday parties and happy hours and that sort of thing. But unfortunately, people, you know, you get confused that that's not really in corporate culture. Corporate culture is about what you talk about, what you invest in, you know, how you speak to certain people. So, you know, you can have a sponsorship, you know, at the Gay Pride Parade, but if you're not backing that up with who you promote and the types of conversations you have at work and how you treat people and what conversations you shut down right away, then it doesn't matter. That's not really part of your corporate culture. And it goes on for, you know, on and on so many different things. And then, of course, you know, training and, you know, are you really coaching, developing, you know, helping people get better and be better and do a better job? And then stability. I think there's, especially banks, we offer stability to people. Generally speaking, you know, banks, even though we consolidate, that those new entities stay around for a long, 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 long time. And you get to understand your work and where you're going. And being in a regulated environment is negative many times, but a lot of times I view it as positive, because you have the government waking up every day saying, we want you to be in business and make money and be around for a long, long time. And so those are some of the things that banks have to really hone in order to combat the sort of the mindset change in a lot of workers.
Okay. Now, you mentioned the importance of culture. How do you foster culture now when so many teams are working remotely?
So first of all, we get people here. So I'm a strong proponent of getting people in the office, interacting, talking. And I think if you're a leader, you got to do, you know, maybe, you know, your workforce. And so for example, if you're in media, a lot of that, you actually have to be, you know, quiet and work alone. And work alone is probably a good idea, and it should have been happening, you know, sooner. But culture, I believe, you know, comes from the top. So whether it's your, you know, board directors, but most specifically the CEO or department head or whatever, but it comes from the top, and it has to be constant communication. And so there's a bunch of, you know, things I do, and, you know, usually not enough, but regular emails, Zoom calls, getting the message out and talking to people. And sometimes talking to people is through an email communication in your own voice, reinforcing things. So for us, it's about, you know, transparency and working together and values and making sure that we hone in on mission and client service and connecting with your employee. So, you know, always talking to, you know, our managers, where it's, you know, my job to communicate to everybody. It's your job to specifically talk one-on-one with everybody. And I try to do one-on-one meetings, but at the end of the day, every employee should feel that there is a supervisor, a manager, an executive, that they can have a one-on-one meeting to understand, you know, where things are, where they're going, and how we move forward. So the communication is still how we convey the culture.
Apollo Bank founder, chairman, and CEO Eddie Arriola joining us. Thank you for downloading Florida Business Minds, presented by the Florida Business Journals and brought to you by Tico Peoples Gas, at the heart of Florida's energy.